All right, hi everybody, and welcome to the Lecture 72 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today's title, the title of today's lecture is The Ominous, The Coming of the Civil War. So we are very close now. And as we discussed yesterday, it's really crucial to have a forward-looking perspective on the events of the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and so on, and pretty much everything after the Missouri Compromise. It's really important to have a forward-looking perspective in the sense of an anticipatory kind of perspective on the past, to say, I know what's coming. What's coming is the Civil War. And so this is what gives us a bridge to the present. So I was identifying this recently in light of the challenges that we have in order to be motivated with all of this map work that we're doing. And so I've updated the class webpage now, and I've posted the new Anchor Fact timeline with the Civil War, even though we haven't yet discussed the Civil War in class. Okay, so, but the next time I teach this course, I guarantee you, I'm going to introduce this as an anchor fact before we even get to it in class. And so I've used a portrait of Abraham Lincoln for the purpose of symbolizing it, because evidently he is the one person above all that we associate with the Civil War. So that's going to be the standout symbol from 61 to 65. So now we have that in our expanding anchor fact timeline. So now you have it in a kind of way that can remind you whenever you are struggling a little bit to think about why something matters in American history in the 1800s. This is a surefire way to a really strong test to figure out how much it matters. If it's connected to the Civil War, you've got it. You've got it. Because what you've got is a connection to the abolition of slavery. So once you've got that, you've got it. Now, of course, you've only got it. I mean, I say that with a little bit of a caveat here or reservation. You don't necessarily have it. I mean, it's if you make the connection and you identify that the Civil War resulted in the abolition of slavery in America, you still don't necessarily have it. What do you think? You know, what's missing there if that's what you've got? Which is good, better than not, but can you see that there's still something missing? I'm going to give you a chance in a minute here, Keen, but I want to try to spur the others here to make this identification. So what is it that's missing? The Civil War got rid of slavery in America. Okay. Bria, I didn't catch that. What's your answer?
You have to understand what the impact of the war did on everyone else.
Well, maybe, but it's not. That's kind of vague, so I'm not sure what you mean by that.
How it changed the world and what it did in order to understand the Civil War, sort of.
Okay, so I think I understand that. So what you mean is kind of connected to its broader context, the rest of American society, the rest of the world, and so on. That's true, but it's not what I'm shooting for. So you're right that one of the ways in which we can kind of gain meaning from any historical knowledge that we acquire is by interconnecting it with other things that we know. So we can compare what's going on in America with what's going on in Europe, with what's going on in Asia, and so on, and cross-connect them. That is useful to do. But that's not what I'm shooting for here. There's something else that's missing, you know, and it has to do with an anchor fact, right? An anchor fact has to do something. It does, because it's an anchor fact, it does cross-connect. It does interconnect with other facts. And we've done that repeatedly. We've cross-connected our facts. But it's got a fundamental function that is more important than that. So what does it have to do, Keen?
It has to connect to the present. You have to say the Civil War is important because it abolished slavery in the United States, and therefore we don't have slavery today.
Okay. So now, yes, that is where we need to go. So now that Keen has given us the first step in this crucial identification, I think this is a really interesting thought because do you need to know about the Civil War to see that we don't have slavery today? Do you need to know about the Civil War to see that? This is an easy question, so everybody's hands up. Do you need it? Juliet?
No.
No, it is apparent that there is no slavery today. That's not a hard question, right? So what then do you need the Civil War for? It's obvious we don't have slavery today. What's the difference between a person who walks around and who sees his fellow man, you know, just walking around in the street freely and everything is, and so on, and the person that knows about the Civil War, and the person who knows, more importantly, about the Civil War in connection to the entire history of mankind? What will you have if you're able to have that awareness that the basically historically illiterate person will not have? That's the real question here. Because it's hard. History education is a war. It's a war to turn on a part of the mind that has atrophied in modern culture. It's a war to turn your minds back on. Because nowadays, I mean, this should be an easy question to answer, but it's not and it's not your fault. Just because nobody talks about these things properly anymore. But it should be easy to answer this question. What's the difference between the mind of a person who is walking around with this whole context and with the Civil War and the mind of the person that doesn't? It's not what you can see. It's not what you can see. That's obvious. Keen, what is it?
I'd say it's what they can do. They can act upon, they can make decisions based on the knowledge they have.
Yes, but that is derivative. Action is derivative. There's something more fundamental. It's what you know, what you are aware of, and connected to that, and leading to action, is what you appreciate. That's part of it. That we're talking about knowledge and we are talking about appreciation. So what does that word mean? That's an interesting word, the word appreciation. It's a very cool vocabulary word. So if you are aware of history, properly aware of history, you can appreciate the fact that America is free of slavery. If you are not aware, you cannot appreciate it. What do you suppose that means? I mean, think about everybody that's walking around the street today. If you go on YouTube, you find these interviews of college students. They're complete ignoramuses. They don't know anything. I mean, they know that Brad Pitt is married to Angelina Jolie, but they don't know when slavery was eradicated. And so what do they not? I mean, they're walking around without being able to appreciate what? This is the tragedy of the failure of education. They can't appreciate, yeah, Timothy's right, anything. But what one real great ultimate value, Rhea?
Their freedom.
Freedom. Yeah, exactly. Freedom. They're walking around free and they don't get it. They don't have a clue what that means. So, man, freedom is wasted on so many people today. It's so tragic. It's sad and it's upsetting it's upsetting to me as a historian, because I know that there are people in the world that know what freedom is and that want it but can't have it. And at the same time, I know that there's a massive quantity of Americans walking around who don't care one bit for freedom. Don't have a clue what it is, don't appreciate it at all, and it's completely wasted on them. That's something that gets my blood boiling a bit. And so this is, I mean, if you want to appreciate what you've got, because believe me, it is precious and it is rare. And there's no guarantee you'll continue to have it throughout your life. So if you want to appreciate it, you need to understand this story. You need to know that all the way up until the Civil War, basically, and in rare cases in other places, because of the British, slavery was everywhere. And so it's just the fact that you can walk around today and neglect this awareness and just be this brain dead person who just is free and doesn't even know what that is. I mean, all of that is a gift that so many people don't deserve. But it's so precious, and it comes from the Civil War. And it's a beautiful thing that the opposite side of this point that I'm trying to make is what I'm trying to give you is what I feel. It's not every moment of every day, and it's not, I mean, I think it can be more, and I find it growing inside of me as an awareness, and as an appreciation and as a feeling. But you can tell that when I'm talking about this, it matters so much to me. I hope you can tell. And that's part of it, is that I get to care about this. It's a whole world that I know of and cherish that other people are not aware of. So they are completely value deprived and don't even know it. There's this giant world of values and passion out there, and most people will never even know that they didn't have it. And there'll be this huge void in their life, and they don't even know it. They're free and they don't even appreciate it. There's no slavery around them and they don't get at all that is a wonder. That is just a fantastic accomplishment of very few rare human beings who took the necessary steps to getting rid of it in our world. And without them, we'd still have it. It's really, really staggering. So that to me is this whole story. It's a heroic tale of a great struggle to do something that is so hard to do. I mean, I feel almost similar in championing history in a culture today that doesn't give, that doesn't care at all about history. Here I am trying to it's my professional purpose in life to try to revive history. It's very similar to me. It's inspirational to me, as somebody who's kind of fighting for a cause that nobody cares about. It's really inspirational to me to see these people doing it. And so when we're talking about this phase of history, we're going to go back to our maps. That's something to know and to become to learn to appreciate that we have just some heroic people. We're going to talk about some of them today that helped make that happen, and that our life is so much better because of them. So, let's go back to our maps, which are not about the past, and think about how we became free, how beyond the Declaration of Independence, which is the key, but now we have to go through past the obstacle of slavery and get to another level. And make an improvement even on that. And here we are in 1850, and what's so, scary about this, I mean, it's exciting and scary at the same time, is that things are going backwards at this point. They're going backwards, but it's so interesting because In order to go forward, sometimes you have to go backwards first. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's an expression out there, something about how you know, one step back, two steps forward, or something like that. Sometimes you have to, you have to get a running start in order to actually leap over a great obstacle. Or sometimes you have to go backwards in order to go forwards. And this appearance in America of this green blob in the center, is a step backwards. It represents a great failure. It represents, definitely one of the steps backwards, and the architects of it deserve scorn. But at the same time, fortunately, because this happened, eventually the conflict between the North and the South became so great that it had to be resolved. So again, looking back from the Civil War, we know that eradicated slavery. We know it was a terrible tragedy, and Americans killed each other. But we live in the aftermath of that, and that means no more slavery. So all of this leads us there. It's all part of the tale of how we get to a world without slavery. So, we get to a world without slavery in a very strange way. What's the green? What's the green on this map? And its role in the story. So first the easy question. What is the green? There was a phrase that we used yesterday. It involved two words. And it said in the green area, we're going to have a new way of doing things. It's not blue. It's not pink. So what's it going to be? King?
Popular sovereignty, where people vote to determine slave or free.
Okay. Right. So we're starting to get this new principle. Slavery by democracy. If you want it, you just got to go there and you will vote. And if you vote for slavery, you can have slavery. So this was definitely a step back. It's a step back because we know that California joins the Union. It's a free state. That's a step forward. But now, in order to appease the South, we have this implementation of popular sovereignty in 1850. And, that becomes a precedent. It becomes now a part of American thinking with regard to the issue of slavery. So we get now to the next phase. 1854. So watch what happened. Tell me what happens. Describe what happens. 1850. 1854. So what happened? What do you see, Timothy?
Okay, so the rest of the unclaimed territory became free territory, but the Missouri, I think it, the Missouri Compromise thing, that line was drawn, and now it's going to be voted for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Very good. Right. So we have the Oregon Territory, and it's being officially now designated as off limits to slavery. But the Louisiana Territory now, and with the Missouri Compromise line, is being changed. And we have this new area where popular sovereignty becomes operative. So this is in 1854, is called the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Because we have, this is called the Kansas Territory. I mean, this right here is exactly where the state of Kansas is today, right? And on top of it, we have the state of Nebraska. But so this was called the Nebraska Territory and the Kansas Territory. And so in 1854, the law said we will have popular sovereignty in the Kansas Territory. We start to see the expansion of the principle of popular sovereignty. And the advocates of slavery were making the case that the Compromise of 1850 took precedence over the Compromise of 1820. So in other words, they're saying from now on, in principle, that the truth is that popular sovereignty is what should apply in any territory, not any federal dictate. And so they're trying to make progress here for slavery, in effect, and say we're going to have it so that people can vote in territories. And this was the first step. Again, a kind of compromise. But notice now what's happening with the compromises. They're going in a certain direction. And it's not a good one. Right? So we're starting to get more and more territory that's open to slavery. It doesn't mean we're going to have slavery, and it's going to take time for the issue to be decided. Because in a democracy, well, the majority rules. So you've got to get enough people into that territory to even have a government and then have them vote and make the decision. So, you know, that none of that is certain. But that's exactly why we start to get towards the Civil War. And a very kind of interesting story about democracy. Because if you have something like this at stake, one of the reasons why people are so unclear about the nature of democracy is we live in a time where we're very fortunate in many regards not to have certain issues at stake. And therefore, we don't have to be quite as afraid of democracy as we might otherwise be. Although there are some scary things going on democratically, but not as bad as this, right? But when you get an issue like slavery and you have democracy, well, then it really jumps out at you. Wait a minute, this is not a good thing. You could have a vote and you could have slavery. So in that context, it really jumps out at you. You can't kind of maintain any illusions that just, oh, voting is this nice thing that we do, and it's such a valuable thing, and it's good and everything. And that's kind of the way people feel today. They feel all warm and fuzzy about voting, and they say, vote, 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 you gotta go out and vote. Well, in a way, they again, it's an issue of appreciation. They don't see fully what that means. And it's when you get instances in history like this one, where the issue is slavery, and you say, vote, go out and vote, that, wow, it becomes kind of daunting. You think, oh my gosh, what we're saying here is that if the one group is bigger than the other, that leads to slavery. Wow, that's That's not a pleasant thought. So how can you secure yourself, or how can you have freedom that's secure from democracy? Becomes a really important question. Because you need something else. Obviously, democracy is not enough. I mean, we have this notion that voting is good, but do you see it? Voting over whether or not people should be slaves? That can't be. Something's gone wrong, right? So this is where you get to see kind of the logic of it, and in a pure form without all of the complexities that sometimes render things unclear. And so what happened as of 1854 is a situation that historians call this chapter leading up to the Civil War. They call it Bleeding Kansas. It's a pretty icky sounding thing, but it gives you a good hint as to what's going to happen, right? What's going to happen in Bleeding Kansas? Because now there's popular sovereignty, and it's the first place where people from the East are likely to go in order to resolve this. If you're going to fill a territory, you know, I mean, Kansas is the first one going in that direction. So what happened? What happened in Bleeding Kansas when popular sovereignty was instituted? What happened? Keen, go ahead.
Well, people rushed there to try to settle and be able to vote for slavery or freedom when that came.
Right. They rushed in, two competing sides. And what was even worse was they created two competing governments. So now that becomes, there are some people that think that's a good thing. Some people that believe in this idea of competing governments and all these, they should just look at Kansas and get over themselves. And so it's an example of what that is. I mean, it's anarchy. There was competing governments and, of course, competing just violence. Because now you've got, it's not just about, you know, kind of voting. It's about, well, how many people do you have on your side? And if you want to be the government, you can't have another government right next to you competing with you over the authority over that particular territory. So basically this became a mini civil war. And people were killing each other. And because what was at stake was who could claim to be the government and thus in charge of the vote and thus whether or not there would be slavery. Which just sounds awful, of course. But the good thing about it was this. Here's where history is not always that easy to understand, and sometimes we run up against things in history that are very unpleasant, and yet, if we look at them and think about them in context, we appreciate that they were ultimately good things. And this violence, I would say, was a good thing. Does that sound like kind of a disturbing thought? This violence was a good thing. Piper, can you imagine a situation in which, in your life, in which violence would be a good thing?
No.
You can't.
Well, I can, imagine it, but I wouldn't like.
Oh, no, of course not. All right, but imagine a situation. Give me an example.
War.
A good thing? And well, okay, no, personal life. Imagine personal violence in which it would be a good thing. What do we call that kind of violence where you have to enact violence, but it's a good thing?
When you're defending yourself?
Yeah, right. Self-defense, right? So, I mean, if you're, maybe not you, but maybe another person, right? If somebody is being, if you're the victim of a crime or you're seeing a crime witnessed, and you enact violence in order to stop them, that's a good thing. So, in particular, if you yourself are being the victim of a crime and you have to defend yourself, well, the law is pretty good on that particular point, right? That's called self-defense. And so, yeah. So violence, I mean, it depends, right? Whether or not it's good or bad. Now, some people take the view that violence is inherently wrong. So I don't ascribe to that view. But when you're, if you go and study philosophy or other things in college, yeah, you'll get interesting challenges about different views. Some people will say violence is never acceptable. Some people will say, well, it depends. And some people will say, oh, you can do whatever you want. And there are all different kinds of views about morality. But I'm going to take the view that violence is contextually, we'd have to judge it contextually. And that's the way the law works, thankfully. If you happen to kill somebody in self-defense, you don't go to prison. That's not a crime. If you are an aggressor, if you're a criminal, then you do. And that's a very important distinction, and I think that's true. It's not just the law. I think that's right. And so in this case, I think, and we have a kind of a historical example of when violence is right. Because if you live in a society that is basically proliferating slavery, this is my question for you. How could you live with yourself? Try to imagine, right, you know, today, getting out of bed, you're free. Nothing has changed for you. But next door, your neighbors have slaves. And down the street, there's a house where people have slaves. And in the neighborhood next to you, most of the people have slaves. So, but, you know, it's legal. How has your life changed? I mean, is it the same life that you have now? And if you just walk around pretending that it is the same, I mean, what has become of you? And what has become of the country that you live in, if in this imaginary world that I've just created for you? Are you willing to live in that world? Bria says no. Ben, you okay with it?
No.
No? Oh, okay. Nice to know. Okay, good. Curious here. When I don't hear an answer, I'm not sure if I'm getting a yes or a no. All right, so what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? Bria?
Either fight or try to make some sort of resolve to where we're understanding
it is not right. Okay, right. So I'm going to switch those around on you. You would start with an attempt to resolve the issue in a civilized manner, right? I mean, you would, as has been going on in American history from 1787 all the way to 1854, you're trying to do it in a civilized manner. You're trying to change the laws. You're trying to change the culture. You're trying to get the change without having to resort to violence. But at a certain point, if that goes on forever, then basically you ain't doing nothing. Right? I mean, how, at what point do you allow yourself to wake up in the morning and pretend to yourself that you stand for freedom when your whole life your neighbors have had slaves and you don't do anything about it? Oh, yeah, you write a letter to the editor. Oh, you know, you do this and that. And you, is that enough for you to get out of bed and be able to look in the mirror and say, I'm happy with myself morally. I'm a good person. That's enough, right? I mean, so for a lot of people, you know, they don't take issues that seriously. For a lot of Americans, it was difficult to take the issue seriously. Except that over time, there came to be a social movement in America that was just unwilling to compromise. And it was called abolitionism. The abolitionists were the leaders of a moral awakening, a moral uprising. They yelled at everybody in America and they said, "You are wrong. How dare you live with yourself? How can you live with yourself in this situation? This is wrong. We need to eradicate slavery." Probably the greatest champion of abolitionism was William Lloyd Garrison. There were others, and I don't mean to slight anybody who made contributions, because there were a number of them. And as a student of history, if you move on and learn more about history, this is something to study a great deal. And the people of the movement of abolitionism are heroes that you should learn more about. I choose William Lloyd Garrison. He's my personal favorite. And so William Lloyd Garrison made a newspaper called The Liberator. And I thought there was something really great here on Wikipedia from The Liberator. In the first issue, he wrote an op-ed piece, right, a kind of a declaration to the public concerning, so this is in 1831, and he wrote a declaration to the public, and I love this. This is what heroes are made of. Nowadays, we have a serious problem in clarity when it comes to thinking about certain things, and we have this phrase in American culture that's a really alarming phrase or a really alarming term. There's a smear word in American culture called extremism. If you're an extremist nowadays, everybody thinks that's somehow bad. But this is a disastrous notion. Obviously, if you are extremely evil, that's one thing. But it's ridiculous to categorize people who are extremely good with the people who are extremely bad. And in the case of the abolitionists, I love their language. And William Lloyd Garrison is saying, "I will not speak with moderation on this topic. If your house is on fire, you do not give a moderate alarm. If your wife is being raped," is what this word really is, "you do not moderately respond to the attacker. If your baby is going to die in an accident, you do not moderately or gradually take her out of the, right? Moderation. You don't equivocate. You don't." So he's saying, we have slavery in our society, and I am not going to be moderate in what I have to say about that. It's time to kill this institution, and that's what I stand for. And so this is how a hero talks. So when we come back to the story of of Bleeding Kansas, this is why it became Bleeding Kansas, because the two sides were now getting further apart, not closer together. It wasn't a compromise. It's the idea that it's either or was becoming stronger. The notion that it's freedom or slavery, the contradiction cannot be sustained, was getting more powerful in people's minds, which is, of course, correct. The problem is, by this point, there was no way to resolve it except violence. And the ultimate indication of the disaster of compromising with slavery came in 1857. It's over here. When a slave named Dred Scott sued for his freedom. This became a very famous, infamous case in American history, known as the Dred Scott case. And what happened was, he was a slave owned in, I forget what area here, but he had, I think it was Missouri. Yeah, he was it. No, wait a minute. I can't remember. You can look up the details. But he was a slave owned by a southern slave owner. And then he was taken up into the north by his owner into the Minnesota Territory. So he was taken. Let's see here. What's a good? Yeah. He was taken up here into the Minnesota Territory. And, well, that's blue, right? Bria, go ahead. Okay, he's taken up in the Minnesota Territory, which is blue on our map, and then brought back and maintained as a slave, and so he sued his owner in court, and he said, I'm not a slave anymore, because you brought me here, and that means I'm free. And so he sued his owner, and the court and the case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, the ultimate authority on the laws of the United States. So this is called the Dred Scott case. And something astounding happened. Keen, go ahead.
Wasn't there a law that, I feel like I'm missing something here. There was a law that was passed before this that said if a slave crosses into free territory, he is free, right?
No. Sadly not. No, it was the opposite.
There was.
In 1850, and prior to that, but in 1850, there's something called the Fugitive Slave Law. So if you were to escape from your master and go to the North, it's the opposite. It was the legal responsibility of every person in the North to capture slaves. And if you harbored slaves, you were committing a crime and you would be fined and you could be imprisoned. So it was much worse than that, the Fugitive Slave Law. Now, of course, people broke the law. There was what was called the Underground Railroad, but that's why it was underground, because basically people were breaking the law, doing the right thing, but breaking the law. Bria, go ahead.
Oh, I did it again.
Oh, okay. So no, it's the other way around, Keen, sadly. So he was brought up into the North by his owner, then brought back. He sued for his freedom. And the Supreme Court charged with interpreting the laws of the United States said, no, you're still a slave. In fact, what the court said was, ultimately, the United States government has no say over what happens in territories. The issue of slavery is up to the states. And so if you're a citizen of Missouri, then you are entitled to have slaves. And the federal government can do nothing about that. By law. So what happened here, which was staggering, and I'm going to bring this up on the in this particular program here, effectively. What the federal government was saying was, the government of the United States cannot enforce slavery in the territories. That was the meaning of the Dred Scott case. So, now you know why we end up with a civil war. I'll have to make a map that says 1857, because that's what it was. 1857 is when this situation arose, because of the Dred Scott case. So obviously, you can't live in the United States that looks like that. If you're a free man and you have had your moral awakening and you understand the evil of slavery, this is unacceptable. I mean, it's all unacceptable, but sometimes it takes, you know, that crisis. It takes something extra to push people to action. It takes more than just an abstract sort of threat to compel them to act properly. So what we'll see on Monday is, well, that came. The two sides just could not live with each other anymore. And the North decided it's time to put our lives on the line here. We stand for freedom, and that's not something you do from your couch. Right. Scary map, right? That scares me. Okay, so we're getting there. Tomorrow, of course, we'll take a pause, relax a bit, do some history through art. But then when we come back, it's time for the Civil War. Talk to you tomorrow, folks. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.